Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, Utah's religious leaders advocate for enhanced penalties for hate crimes. Utah House Republicans retaliate against Governor Gary Herbert after disagreeing over how a recent special election was handled. A proposed overhaul for the Utah Transit Authority is in the works. And Representative Chris Stewart pays a visit to the legislature to tell lawmakers that the real scandal in Washington isn't Russian election meddling. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Welcome back, Dan.
Good morning.
Salt Lake Tribune reporter Luke Ramseth is here with us as well. Good morning, Luke.
Good morning.
And Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke joins us as well. Thanks for being here, Robert.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. If you've got a question or comment about the stories that we're covering today, you can post them at sltrib.com or you can call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. The first week of this year's legislative session wraps up today. There's already a lot on the table to discuss, and really we could dive in anywhere. Luke Ramseth, this week you wrote about some hot-button issues, an abortion bill, a medical marijuana bill, a birth control bill. To start with, let's tackle what is likely the more controversial of those topics. There's a bill to ban abortions in Utah under certain circumstances. Luke, what is this bill about, and who's running it, and why?
Yeah, the sponsor is Representative Carrie-Anne Lisenby. And the idea, her idea, is that if a woman's sole reason to seek an abortion is that the fetus tested positive for Down syndrome, then the doctor would be banned from carrying out that abortion.
Okay, so a mother, prospective mother, has a test, determines that her fetus tests positive for Down syndrome, and then based on that diagnosis, she makes a decision to terminate her pregnancy based on that diagnosis alone, and that would be a crime for the doctor.
Not for the woman. It'd be a Class A misdemeanor for the doctor. The way that Lisenby is pitching this is, you know, this is protecting Down syndrome children, and it's about discrimination and that kind of thing.
How would a law enforcement agency determine that a woman made a decision to have an abortion based solely on this diagnosis instead of because of other considerations?
Yeah, I think that's a huge question mark. She hasn't really spelled it out. She was sort of asked about the enforcement aspect of it at this Monday press conference, which was pretty well attended up at the Capitol, kind of announcing it, and she didn't really address that too much. But yeah, I think that's a pretty significant question because how's a doctor going to know that's the one thing that, say, is on a woman's mind and that's why she's seeking it? Maybe sometimes they might, but yeah.
Would it be enforceable, I guess, is the question, and yet to be determined. There are opponents of this of Lisenby's bill. What do they say about this? You attended a committee hearing.
I think generally the opponents say this is just a bill that is sort of meant to restrict abortions. It's not about protecting Down syndrome children, it's just kind of limiting a woman's right to choose in general. A really emotional hearing last night, House committee hearing. Many people on both sides, including people who have Down syndrome, that actually spoke, and a lot of other groups too. I mean, the ACLU is opposed to this. They were up there, and there's an argument too that it's just not constitutional. So,
right, and there's a note attached to this bill, a constitutional note, if that's what we can call. Actually, just before we head to that, either Dan Harry or Robert Gerke maybe can comment on this. Do we have constitutional notes at the legislature? I kind of thought that the state of Utah had either done away with them or dialed them back. And at the same time, we should define what the term is. What is a constitutional amendment? Yeah.
So if legislative attorneys see a bill that they suspect might be constitutional, they do further research on precedent on the issue, and on this one in particular. And then if they do the research and it comes back that there's the standard is a high probability that the courts would strike it down as unconstitutional, they attach what they call a constitutional note. It's sort of a warning to legislators that, you know, if you pass this, you're going to get sued and you're probably going to lose. They're rare. I mean, we see them, you know, maybe two to sometimes as many as four times a year, but sometimes we don't even have any. So they're exceedingly rare. Mm-hmm. This one did get a constitutional note because there have been court rulings. I believe it was Ohio. Is it Ohio that the court struck it down?
Indiana.
Yeah. And so there is precedent on this, and it's the attorneys are warning that if they pass it, they're going to buy themselves a lawsuit that they're going to lose, basically.
A reminder to our listeners that you can join this conversation with your questions and comments. 801-355-8255 is the number to call, or you can comment at sltrib.com. Back to you, Luke. This bill has that designation that it would be challenged on constitutional grounds or has a high probability of that if it becomes law. Knowing that, what happened to this bill in committee last night? I mean, you know, what did lawmakers do with this bill in committee last night?
It was an incredibly kind of long hearing on it, and a fair amount of discussion, but they passed it. I mean, it passed the committee, and there was some discussion initially of whether they should send it back to the Rules Committee, and just kind of, you know, a few legislators said we needed just a total kind of revamp on this thing. To remove even the ban on abortion part and leave some other components in there perhaps or something like that. But anyway, no, that's not what happened. It ended up just moving ahead, I think 8-3. Some discussion and even acknowledgement that this might be, a very likely lawsuit for the state and that perhaps it could be unconstitutional, but a decision to go ahead anyway.
Robert Gerke, news columnist, I'm going to ask you to wade into a minefield here, which is kind of your MO as a columnist.
Mm-hmm.
From where you sit, what is this bill all about?
It's about posturing. Utah can't stand that other states have tried to pass stricter limits on abortion. So these Utah representatives, you know, Representative Lisenby goes, you know, stampeding into this issue. There's no question it's unconstitutional. They don't care. They love the Constitution except when it tells them they can't do things they want to do. They haven't identified this as being a problem in this state, you know, and I don't think that from what my understanding of the committee was last night, there wasn't a single instance where they can identify that this has happened. And that it would actually be enforced. And then you got to the question about is it enforceable? Well, no, it's not. And so, it's posturing. And so they take these bills from other states that other states have tried to pass. And so they can look like, you know, going into an election year, so they can look like they're tough on this issue. And it's, you know, and it's just going to cost taxpayers money.
Fighting a lawsuit
okay. that we're going to lose.
Dan Harry, government editor, we'll turn to some other news actually here in a moment, but that political aspect of this is that, I guess, do you have any comments on this, anything that we might be leaving out of this story?
Well, I think Robert's right. It's posturing, but also, you know, these are people that sincerely are anti-abortion. I mean, in their bones, a lot of these legislators would try to do anything to stop abortions. And I don't think... it's all about sincere beliefs. I think the fact that it is an election year makes a difference. You, generally speaking, covering the legislature year in and year out, you expect to see abortion bills in election years. And this happens to be an election year.
Well, it makes for an interesting fight at the session and maybe afterwards as well if the bill passes. Luke Ramseth, thanks for covering this. We need to move on to other topics because there's still much to cover. Is there any other big piece of this that we're missing before we move on from this story?
The other piece that was discussed a bit last night is there is a requirement that that doctors do certain things for a woman who has had a test for Down syndrome, which is like give them resources for advocacy groups that know about Down syndrome, refer to them to a specialist, kind of have an in-person meeting, that kind of stuff. So that's another component of it that you might see kind of a broader array of people saying, okay, that's fine. Although some medical groups would say, no, that's, why are you wading into that? Because that's a decision a doctor and their patient should be able to kind of figure out.
So. And this could be up on the House floor, I guess, as early as Monday, right?
I don't know. Okay. Perhaps, yeah.
We will see. Guys, I want to turn to Tribune government editor Dan Harry and some news that came out just yesterday. Dan, this is also from the legislature. There's a plan in the works to make some pretty substantial changes to the Utah Transit Authority. And maybe where we could start is with what would happen to UTA's board under this proposal.
Yeah, so this is a proposal that's been in the works for quite a while. They had a task force that spent a year looking at different things. And one of the major changes to UTA would be to do away with what is now a 16-person board. And the members are appointed by all kinds of different government entities. There are counties, there are cities, there are planning associations that appoint members. And instead, that would be replaced with a 3-member full-time commission that would be appointed by the governor. The idea behind it is to bring accountability to UTA, which in the past has, I think everybody might acknowledge, lacked some accountability.
It has this – it's been struggling for years with a public perception problem. Maybe you can give us that background a little bit.
Yeah. So they've had issues with very high executive salaries, with international travel that was somewhat questionable that tax money's being used to pay for, with kind of accusations of insider trading and sweetheart deals with developers. Some of whom have been board members. But the main criticism that this is trying to address is that you have full-time people running the agency and you have this part-time, very large board that meets only occasionally, and that essentially what has happened is they have been co-opted and rubber stamp whatever the agency itself wants to do. So the idea behind it is to bring back some oversight and accountability to it.
This 3-member commission, you take a 16-member, as you said, part-time board mm-hmm. and bring it down to a 3-member board mm-hmm. or commission. They would be essentially employees. They would be a full-time
right.
working constantly on this.
They compared it to the state tax commission, which is, full-time commissioners appointed by the governor.
And that's the same way it would work here. They're appointed by the governor, but they might be nominated by other entities, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not sure I know the nomination process, yeah. but the governor would be responsible for appointing them, and he would have the power to remove them, at will, I believe.
Part of the nomination process, as I understand it, is that they want to maintain right now there's regional representation on the current board, and they kind of want to try to maintain that. So I think there's one from Salt Lake County or that's nominated by the Salt Lake County governments, one that's by the northern part, Davis County, and then Tooele County as well, and then one for Utah County and
surrounding areas.
Juab County, yeah. So
there are 6 counties that are in the transit district.
Yeah, okay. And so they kind of get to provide their nomination that way. So to maintain some regional voice, just because, and if I may, this is one of the big criticisms that the counties have right now in the cities is that they're the ones who pay for UTA, and they're losing a significant part of their voice on the authorities if this reform goes through. And so that's one of the things they're kind of fighting out right now. If the county's argument is that, well, and the city's is if we're going to fund it, we want to have oversight and say in how the money's spent.
And three members means that maybe they won't have as much oversight.
They won't have the same sort of hands-on influence on who's making the decisions.
Dan, Harry, other parts of this proposal include making a tax increase or making the tax increases to support transit. Happen automatically after a certain period of time. These are tax increases that have been considered by various areas.
If you remember, in 2015, we had a Proposition 1 on the ballot, which was to raise sales tax for roads, local roads, and transit. And that passed in Weber, Davis, and I think Tooele counties, but it failed in Salt Lake and Utah and Box Elder counties. And of course, Salt Lake and Utah counties are the biggest counties, the most populous, and they pay the most freight for transit sales taxes. They turned it down. It was largely attributed to a lack of public trust in UTA. And so what this bill proposes to do would say, you have to take advantage of all the available sales taxes that the legislature has given you authority to pass, which means this Prop 1.
Yeah.
And if you don't pass it by 2022, it will be imposed.
Okay.
So that's going to be very controversial. I mean, you have a tax that was turned down by voters, and now the legislature is saying, well, you better pass this or we're going to shove it down your throat.
Okay, we're restoring public trust, and then if you don't have that public trust, we're going to make you take this tax.
They're not talking about restoring public trust to the legislature. They're talking about it for the UTA.
All right, Robert Kirky, any comments on that aspect of this?
I think that's Dan hit on the other sort of controversial piece of this that's going to cause it problems is that the voters, by significant margins in those counties, rejected a tax because they didn't trust UTA. And so now to have that anyway, despite the voters' will and wishes, is going to be a hard pill to swallow.
Got it. Actually, before we head to a break, there's a piece of this that has to do with electric vehicles,
yeah.
A big fee increase for electric vehicles as part of this proposal. Tell us about that.
Right. So the argument behind that is that as you know, originally gas taxes were supposed to cover the costs of roads. And as cars have become more fuel efficient over the years, that has not happened. The gas tax is not covering the costs of maintaining state highways and roads. And so the legislature's kind of floundering to try to find ways to make that up. Right now, there's about $600 million in general taxes that otherwise would be going to other programs to fund state government, now going into state roads every year. And legislators say that's not really fair. You know, the motorists who use the roads should be the ones paying for it. And electric vehicles in particular are ones where they're saying, you know, they're using our highways and not paying their fair share. So they're trying to, I think, quadruple their registration fees for that. Elsewhere today, we had a poll that we just did that looked at a gas tax increase. And, you know, it didn't put a number on it, but it said it asked Utah voters, would you support a gas tax increase? And a plurality said they would support that. So it's about 50% who said they would. It's less than 50% who said they would oppose it. So, you know, that's something that legislators have been very reluctant to look at. And this is an election year. But it looks like from the polling that there may be some public sentiment for, you know, higher gas taxes.
Okay. If I may, I think the thing the poll may distort a little bit is that these are Republican legislators who are more interested in what their Republican constituents believe. And so the Republicans in that poll, I think, were opposed to it in a larger portion.
Right. They were. It was, I think, 53% were something like that were opposed to it.
And this gas tax, the registration fee increase for electric vehicles is something that was in the governor's budget. And if I may,
sure.
On this. It seems like it's sort of a backward thinking. If you're trying to encourage people to get cleaner vehicles, and then you're charging them more for using them, so they've got to come up with some way though, where these cars that do use the roads and you know do take a toll on the roads end up paying for some portion of it. It's also kind of galling, I think, for the legislature to be complaining that there's $600 million going to roads when they passed legislation that the governor had vetoed that would earmarked a significant portion of that for the roads. I think it's about $200 million a year. So, you know, now they come back and complain they don't have enough money for everything else. Well, they did this, so they could, you know, they need to take accountability for it.
Set themselves up for it. Just on the UTA overhaul, getting back to that before we head to a break, Robert Kirky, what do you think its chances of passage are, including that electric vehicle fee, including the 3-member, you know, commission versus the 16-member board? and everything else that comes with it.
I mean, I think it will pass. I think it's a big issue that the speaker wants to get through. With the electric vehicle fee, I'm not so sure. I think they're still trying to adjust that, but the quadrupling it is a significant increase, and so I think that we may see that come down. And the gas tax increase seems to be one that President Niederhauser wants. They just raised the gas tax, I believe, 2 years ago, and then indexed it, so it was supposed to increase with inflation. But gas prices have been so low that they haven't seen any benefits from that. So, you know, a straight ahead increase may be the way that they end up going.
Okay. Well, 114-page bill presented in this committee yesterday hasn't been introduced yet, I don't think, actually.
Right.
It's just been presented.
Right.
Guys, we're going to have to do a quick pause, but when we come back, we'll get back to the legislature and keep looking at the highlights of the first week of the session. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry, reporter Luke Ramseth, and columnist Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news wrap-up. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. Well, we've talked about an abortion bill and a legislative effort to reform the Utah Transit Authority. Staying on Utah's Capitol Hill, Dan Harry, there is a bill related to hate crimes, though its sponsor doesn't exactly want it presented that way, that's under consideration this year. This is Senate Bill 86. It's sponsored by Daniel Thatcher, a West Valley City Republican state senator, and it has the backing of some religious leaders here in Utah. Dan, tell us about this proposal.
Yeah, a couple of dozen religious leaders have written in support of this, and it also has the support of some local governments. One thing that Senator Thatcher did during the interim was go around to local governments, and some cities and counties have endorsed this through resolutions of their city councils or county commissions. And so he wanted to come back to the legislature and show some support for it. You were right in your introduction there. He hates the label hate crimes bill. He thinks that immediately undermines it. He calls it victim targeting. And basically it would enhance penalties if someone was the victim of a crime and it was because they were part of some group of people, whether it be religious or for ethnicity, sexual orientation, or other reasons.
Right. There were a number of ancestry, disability, ethnicity, gender identity, national origin, race, religion, or sexual orientation. You know, I mentioned we'll come back to there have been previous proposals like this, yeah. And I want to get to those and why they didn't pass. But I mentioned the support from religious leaders. What form did that take, and who's in, and also who's not in, which I think is notable here.
Well, yeah, the main thing is who's not in, and this has been the obstacle for a hate crimes legislation that has been back to the Hill now for many years. The LDS Church is not one of the endorsers of this. And in fact, I don't know, how long ago was that they actually were blamed for killing it?
Yeah,
by
it was
the sponsor.
Senator Urquhart sponsored the bill, I believe, 2 years ago, and said he had the votes lined up to get it passed the Senate. And then the church issued a statement saying that they thought it would upend a balance that was struck with his non-discrimination bill that the church was part of negotiating. And so that killed the bill for that session. Changed as many as, I think, 4 votes. And so Thatcher's been working again, you know, with that sort of still hanging out there. The church hasn't said since then if they never really said if they support or oppose the bill, just that it would upend this balance. And so its question now is, you know, 2 years on, is that still applicable? They've been really quiet and really reluctant to say anything further about whether they still think this is something that needs to
happen. And it's expected, you know, we could always be wrong, but it's expected that they'll remain neutral on this. So does that hurt the bill because the legislators are still remembering the opposition to the church a couple years ago? So why is that important? Well, 9 out of 10 legislators are active LDS.
Right.
So that's why it's important.
The Bishop of the Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City wrote this letter in support of the legislation. He seemed to be trying to kind of cajole the LDS Church into getting on board, or at least he talked about the Mormon experience and the identity-based discrimination that Mormons themselves have faced historically and of course still face on occasion.
Yeah, I mean it would cover if an LDS church is targeted or LDS member, you know, missionaries or whatever are targeted for their religious beliefs, just like anybody else's, you know, if a mosque is vandalized or Muslims are attacked. And so, you know, it works both ways.
Why? I mean, okay, actually, this is a question both for Dan and for Robert Gerke or for either of you. Why is Thatcher, it's Daniel Thatcher, right?
Who is Daniel Thatcher, yeah.
Why not call it a hate crimes bill? What is the opposition that he expects because of the label hate crimes bill?
Because for so long, hate crimes has been associated with the gay community and it's cost support in the past. And I think also a couple years ago when Urquhart had the bill and it was called hate crimes, you know, the LGBT groups were pretty aggressive in their lobbying. And he thinks that he needs to distance himself a little bit from that.
It's called rebranding.
Rebranding.
Yeah.
You know, but prosecutors are also very, many of them strongly behind this because we have an actual hate crimes law in the books, but it's unenforceable. It is too convoluted. And so if we want a hate crimes bill, which, you know, we do have one on the books, they want one that actually can be enforced.
Okay.
If I may, just go reaching back to a bill we discussed earlier. I think one of the ironies of this is that the opponents of the bill say, "Well, you're punishing thought and motivation rather than just punishing the crime." But that same rationale doesn't apply to Representative Lisenby's abortion bill, where you can go in and punish the thought and the motivation behind the crime and not just the crime itself. And so there is an inconsistency there that I hope gets brought out as these two pieces of legislation go forward.
No hearing yet for this bill, as far as I can tell. It's been assigned to committee. Robert Gerke, just is this the year that hate crimes or targeting, victim targeting bill will get passed at the Utah State Legislature?
I'd have to say probably not. I think there is a chance it can get through the Senate, although I'm not sure if Senator Shiazawa leaving costs Thatcher a vote. I think it still could have a hard time in the House.
Okay. Once again, a reminder to listeners that you can join us with your questions and comments. We are at 801-355-8255, or you can comment at sltrib.com. Let's squeeze in another bill before we head to our next break. And Luke Ramseth, you wrote this week about a measure by a Republican representative to provide birth control to low-income women, which sounds, I don't know, counterintuitive or surprising for a conservative state like Utah to suggest doing. There's a Medicaid aspect to this as well. But what exactly would this bill do?
Yeah, it's sponsored by Representative Ray Ward. And it would be a Medicaid waiver that the state would seek. So like a kind of a partial Medicaid expansion. And it would cover low-income women who want birth control, and specifically, it's sort of pitched as like a IUD bill, so long acting birth control bill, because that tends to be, I mean, it is more expensive, so often out of the reach of women who are below, I think it's 95% of the poverty line is who this is kind of targeted at for those people.
Okay, so paying for an intrauterine device as opposed to birth control pills, would it also cover?
It's kind of pitched as just a family planning coverage. So it would cover a wide variety of things, yeah.
Is this something that is done in a lot of other states where low-income women are provided support like this?
It is. Yeah, I think Utah is actually one of the few states, I think only one of seven, that have not done this yet. So, and that's something that Representative Ward pointed out, is we're kind of behind on that. And you know, just pointing out, like, why don't we just join the group here? It's kind of a no-brainer.
He envisions this as an economic booster, a potential pathway out of poverty as well for these women.
Yeah, because if you can plan out, I mean, if you can plan out your family, then you can figure out, all right, now I want to go to school and I want to, or maybe I want to work for a while. And so, yeah, economically, it's certainly beneficial for these women, potentially.
Robert Kirky, do you want to weigh in on this proposal from Representative Ward?
I think it's a good idea, so it probably doesn't have much chance. You got to remember with this legislature, they're so conservative that anything that they think might encourage people to have premarital or unprotected or premarital sex is going to be looked at with some scrutiny, and they're not exactly. I mean, I remember a couple years ago where on the Senate floor they had this complex discussion about the women breastfeeding and that they could actually pump, and this was news to them. So I think the nuance of birth control are probably a little bit difficult for them to grasp as well. And so I think you know, the point Luke made is, and the point that Representative Ward made is absolutely right. There's a lot of lip service paid to breaking the cycle of intergenerational poverty, and this would go a long ways toward doing that. But I also think that you know, birth control is a radioactive issue and among the conservative Republican legislators in an election year.
And is that why it hasn't? This hasn't been instituted in the past? I mean, you were one of seven states, you said, Luke, that doesn't have this. Is that, I guess, the reason? Because, as Robert Kirky says, birth control is radioactive in a conservative body.
Maybe you'd be better to answer. But yeah, I think that's probably the reason why exactly. But there is the flip side of that is an argument that appeals to Republicans, and that is that it does potentially save taxpayers money as well in terms of, in theory, because if women can kind of work their lives out and do better economically, then the state is supporting them less and their kids less through social services and that kind of thing.
And I'm going to take it back to Representative Lisenby's bill again, but I think this, if they want to do something that might actually reduce the number of abortions in the state, this is one that they could do rather than putting this show on with the other bill that Representative Lisenby has.
Luke, this bill has cleared its first hurdle, right, in the legislature?
Yeah. House Health Committee. It actually sailed through that pretty easily. So,
okay, Dan, Harry, any comments on this bill before? Maybe we'll head to another pause.
These guys have covered it pretty well.
All right. Guys, we will head to just a quick one more quick pause, and then when we come back, we'll look at the rift between the legislature and the governor over a special election that happened in November, and the comments on what you might call the deep state by Representative Chris Stewart during his visit to the Hill. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Luke Ramseth, and Robert Gerke. It is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. Dan Harry, Salt Lake Tribune government editor, I want to touch now on the divide between the legislature and the governor on how the special election in Utah's 3rd congressional district played out last November. The legislature wanted a say in how that election happened. The governor had other plans and proceeded with the election without that legislative input, I guess. The attorney general weighed in on what the governor was doing, and that weighing in, that opinion that the AG provided, is a sort of bone of contention here. Can you explain that and how the legislature is trying to impose its will, I guess?
Well, the AG didn't weigh in. He prepared a legal opinion on what the governor did that was requested by the legislature. And then just before they gave it to the legislature, he pulled it back and wouldn't release it and made it a protected document. And the legislature was quite upset about that. If you go to Utah state law, it says very clearly one of the duties of the attorney general is to provide written legal opinions to the legislature upon their request. It's not discretionary. It says he shall. So they were pretty upset about that. And the attorney general said the reason that was that he didn't actually point the finger at the governor, but he said issues have been raised that this would be a conflict of interest, and we might be found by the Utah State Bar to have committed an ethical transgression, and so we can't do this.
Because of attorney-client privilege? Was that the idea?
That's what the basis of it was. And, you know, I think this has happened all the time where the attorney general sets up these firewalls within the office, and one side of the office is representing, say, the governor, and the other side is giving an opinion to the legislature. It happens all the time. But this is really the first time where it's become this big issue. And it appears that the governor was the one forcing this. You know, the Tribune went to the mat trying to get the legal opinion itself because we saw this clearly as a public document. The legislature had requested it. They said it was a public document. The attorney general was taking this contrary view that it was a protected document. The records committee, state records committee, ruled unanimously that the public interest outweighed the privacy interest and ordered it released. The attorney general refused to do so and went to court and were fighting it in court. And finally, they reached some deal. In the end, it turned out the attorney general had said the governor, what he did was legal. Huh. So I'm scratching my head to wonder what this really was all about. I don't understand why the governor was so interested in keeping this secret.
But this had to do with how the election played out. I mean, the governor said, we're going to have a special election. It's going to happen on this date.
Yeah, he set all the rules because all the state law says is the governor shall proclaim a special election when there's a vacancy in a U.S. House seat.
As occurred when Jason Chaffetz said he was leaving early.
And so the governor took that as saying, I have the ability to set the rules and the timetable for that. The legislature disagreed and thought they should be able to set the rules. To be fair, you know, to the governor, the legislature had a shot at this last year. They were thinking that Chris Stewart might be appointed to a position in the administration, so there might be a vacancy. And they came close to passing a law that would set the rules, but then backed off over the issue of signature gathering. There's a fight in the Republican Party, as you know, over whether you can get to the primary with by gathering signatures or you must go through the convention. And there are some real hardliners there in the House that insist that you have to do it through a convention.
Is that what this is about, that this proposal making its way through right now, which has to do less with how special elections are set and how the governor makes those choices than it does with releasing opinions that are provided, right?
Yeah, that's what that bill does. But there will be a constitutional amendment coming down the pike that allows the legislature to call itself into special session in limited circumstances. So that's part of this argument as well.
Robert Kirky, why was the legislature unhappy or as concerned as they were with how this special election played out, and does what they're doing to try and fix that process make sense to you?
I think there were legitimate concerns about whether the governor was overstepping his authority, and you know that's a separation of powers issue. They want to be the ones that make the law, and in this instance, as Dan mentioned, they hadn't taken the opportunity to make the law, and so the governor was stepping in to fill the void. And so I think there were legitimate concerns about their separation of powers and their constitutional responsibilities. Does this make sense, the way they're going to go about fixing it? Well, I think I guess we'll have to see what they end up doing. But I think it's good that, you know, that they fill the vacuum that was left in the law. And then hopefully down the road, this won't happen again. I am a little concerned that they're going to give the power to pick that they could change it so that the delegates get to pick the replacement for House seats, because I don't think that's the proper way to do it. And if we did that, then we would have had Chris Herod as a congressman and not John Curtis. And as we saw in the election, the voters wanted John Curtis and not Chris Herod. So I think they need to be careful about how they go about, when they step into that void. I think they need to be a little careful about how they do it.
Some of this obviously has to do with Republican Party politics as well. And maybe a little bit of a divide in Utah over how things, or a big divide in Utah over how things play out generally in elections. What about the idea of the legislature being able to call itself into special session in certain circumstances?
You know, That's an interesting one because I don't necessarily see that as a problem. I mean, it could become one where they call themselves into repeated special sessions because they can't get their work done during the 45-day session, or they call themselves into special sessions when there's not consensus between the legislature and the governor. Because right now, when the governor has to call them in into special session, he'll only do that typically if there's an agreement with the leadership and with the House and the Senate that they're going to do something fairly, you know, fairly routine or there's an agreement on. If you could end up in a situation where the legislature calls itself into special session to, you know, try to embarrass the governor or if there's a fight. But, you know, I mean, maybe that's the way politics should work, too. It's not about all, you know, holding hands and singing kumbaya. You got to hash things out a little bit.
I think it would be a significant shift in the balance of power. I mean, right now you hear legislators talk all the time about the rule of 38, 15, and 1, which means to get anything passed, you got to get 38 votes in the House, 15 in the Senate, and 1 in the governor's office. And this could change that by allowing the legislature to have a lot more control over its agenda. So I'm not arguing that it's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just saying it would be a significant shift
it
in
would
power.
Be. Yeah, absolutely. But it's still at the end of the day, the governor has the veto authority and can, you know, anything they pass in a special session, he can block with his veto pen.
Mm-hmm. But face potentially political consequences as mm-hmm. a result. Well, a battle ahead during this session. We'll see what kind of measures get passed on that. Let's tackle some comments that Representative Chris Stewart made this week. The 2nd District – actually, which district is he from? He's not 2nd District.
2nd District.
Oh, he's 2nd, yeah. He made an appearance at Utah's Capitol. He was in town from Washington for the opening of the session, and he made some comments related to the investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, and he told lawmakers that we're focusing on the wrong thing. Dan Harry, we shouldn't be looking at potential collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, says Stewart. So what should we be looking at?
Well, he's carrying the Republican message, which you're hearing more and more out of Washington, that the real scandal here is the politicization of the FBI, the CIA, and our intelligence agencies. And, you know, it is something that I think is kind of disturbing because it's calling into question these intelligence agencies, which supposedly are keeping us our national security intact. And, Stewart said, and he's the only member of the House Intelligence Committee from Utah, right, saying that there is, and he has always insisted, there is no evidence of collaboration between the Trump campaign and Russia. And he has always stated that this idea of Russian meddling in the election has been overblown. He has always resisted the notion that the intent of the meddling, if there was any, was to get Donald Trump elected. He's taking the party line in this. And, I think the legislature ate it up.
Hmm. Nobody, in his words, Utah legislature, nobody in Congress is talking about collusion anymore. Robert Gierke, does that seem accurate?
I think it's not accurate. There are people in Congress talking about collusion still, and these investigations, the multiple investigations in Congress are still looking at that very issue. And we've seen in recent days, I think, that they've been trying to interview Jared Kushner. They've been they did interview Steve Bannon. The investigations are very much still progressing.
And then the news came out that the president tried to fire Robert Mueller.
Chris Stewart was on cable TV defending that, that's the process, how the process was supposed to work, or the process worked, and it's just, I think Chris Stewart is, got his blinders on a lot. The other thing he said was that when the House investigation comes back, what everybody's going to be shocked about is the Uranium One scandal that involved the Clintons and donations to the Clinton Foundation. That's, that is his, in his eyes, is the big story here that everybody's missing. It's kind of I don't know, maybe we should expect it by now, but the partisan blinders are a little bit shocking.
Well, and the differences between these the House committee that's investigating this versus well, we don't know, but whatever the Mueller investigation might or might not turn up, we're still waiting to see kind of where the other shoe drops there.
Yeah, from everything we can see, it's a pretty serious investigation. The other, you know, Chris Stewart also dropped some other controversial comments. He said this was a congressman who, during the campaign, had called Trump our Mussolini, and now he said he's a huge convert of the president. And he also, he was asked about gerrymandering, and he said, oh, that's nonsense. There is no gerrymandering in Utah. If he said you would have to gerrymander to create a Democratic district. And, you know, if you look now at our current makeup in Congress, Salt Lake County, which is the largest population in the state, has no congressperson that lives in Salt Lake County. So I think you can argue that, you know, there is gerrymandering and it's pretty obvious.
We're running low on time, and I wanted to get maybe we'll just dip into this for one more second. Luke Ramseth, one more legislative-related story, which is about medical marijuana. And what you wrote about this week was was some polling that's been done showing that there is broad support in the state of Utah for medical marijuana. Tell us about that polling, and then whether or not we might see the legislature address it this year.
Yeah, we commissioned a poll recently that showed 76% of Utahns support legalizing medical marijuana and this medical marijuana initiative that is moving forward, ballot initiative.
Right.
It's kind of interesting because that pretty much has stayed steady for months now, right around 75%. Of Utah's support, and that's like, you know, 65% of Republicans are into the idea, 90-something percent of Democrats. So it's just kind of notable that that really hasn't budged at all, the support for this idea of legalizing medical marijuana in sort of a controlled way, but yeah.
And there's a ballot initiative, as you said, signature gathering to try and put it on the ballot. How about lawmakers? Have they unveiled anything yet related to medical marijuana this year?
There is, I think, probably the most notable thing that we may see is Representative Brad Daugh with this right to try bill that he's proposing, which would be people who are like really sick, terminally ill, would be able to, in theory, access marijuana directly through their doctor if they wanted to try it. So it's,
among other things, among other potential treatments, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Yeah. So, but I guess we'll see where that goes. I think the initiative folks feel like, you know, that maybe the legislature is going to take some steps to try to undermine their effort.
Well, there's a lot of initiative efforts out there. Robert Kirk, any comments on this before we head to our underplayed stories?
I mean, I think Luke, there's consistently been public support for legalizing medical marijuana, and the legislature's failed to act, and so that's good news for the ballot initiative backers. My understanding is they're close to 100,000 signatures, so they need 113,000 by March, I believe. And so, you know, they're on target on that respect, and so we'll see in November where voters end up. I think we also need to wait and see what the LDS Church does on this in this regard, whether when we get to it about ballot measure, if they're going to weigh in for it or against it.
Sure. What sort of opinion they express. Guys, it's time now for our underplayed stories of the week. And Gurki, do you want to start? What's your choice for underplayed story?
Well, I think on the topic of polling, we had a poll this week as well that Mitt Romney would have a pretty easy coast to victory when he decides he's going to get into the race. I believe it was Dan 45% lead over Jenny Wilson in a head-to-head matchup in November. And so I think that's good news for Team Romney, I suppose.
Yeah, and notable in that was that he had a majority of independent voters, and even I think it was 20% of Democrats said they would vote for Mitt Romney.
Wow. Has any motion on his announcing? Anybody?
I think we'll see it very, very soon.
Okay.
Probably next week.
Dan Harry, your pick for underplayed story.
I'm going to pick the outdoor retailers, which is having their annual convention. Sorry, Luke, you can expound on it. I just wanted to note the contrast. So they're celebrating in Denver that they're holding the outdoor retailers there, which of course moved from Utah in protest to its leaders' public lands policy against national monuments, for one thing. And at the same time, this is the governor giving his state of the state, talking about cooperation and respecting other people's opinions. And it kind of seemed to stark contrast those two things.
Hmm. Luke, do you want to expand on that or choose another
no,
one?
No, that was my underplayed story. That's all right. Our colleague Aaron Alberti was in Denver and had quite a story yesterday, just kind of laying out. It sounds like a lot of the outdoor retailer folks were kind of doing some Utah bashing and really happy to be gone. And so that was notable.
All right. Check it out at sltrib.com. For my part, I'll go with a legislative committee passing a bill outlining when law enforcement may legally obtain blood draws. And this is in response to the arrest of nurse Alex Wubbles last year for refusing to provide a blood draw. This lays out some guidelines. You have to have a warrant. You have to have a verbal or written confirmation from the patient, or in certain circumstances, you could do it in a different way. I can't remember, but you can find it at sltrib.com. Interesting to see that change as well. Dan Harry, Luke Ramseth, Robert Gerke, all with Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Have a good day.
Have a great weekend. Well, many thanks to Jesse Ellis here at KCBW for his help on the show. Also to our partners at Utah Public Radio in Logan, including Tom Williams, Alyssa Roberts, and Spencer Holsey. And as always, thanks to the show's producer, Emily Means. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org or through your podcast app. Just look for Behind the Headlines. You've been tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.